Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
So, Wednesday morning, after another primary day, still a few votes being counted in Texas, but the big political news is what went down in Georgia, which I think people expected Kemp to beat Perdue at this point because all the polls were very, very clear. But the size of that margin was well beyond what the poll said, and it seemed to, and no one expected the Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, to, because in Georgia you need 50 to avoid a runoff. You know, people thought, okay, the polling looks close enough, he could make it to a runoff, but if it came down to two candidates, he'd be in a jam. Yet he wins the whole thing outright with over 50%.
This guy was written off for dead, Bill. Let me just look at this Politico story. By the way, let's say, I think, am I right? Kemp got about 73% last time I looked. But Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, here's a piece from Politico. This is from March. And the headline is, quote, "He's toast," unquote. GOP leaves Raffensperger twisting in the wind. So he was toast, and yet here he is. The reports of his demise were were premature, certainly.
I mean, Kemp is now at 73.7%, Perdue at 21.8%, and Raffensperger 52.3%. Jody Heiss, Trump endorsed, 33.4%. I mean, he just barely cleared 50%, but he's still 20, just about 20 points ahead of Heiss. And, you know, I wrote a piece at Real Clear Politics for Monday about, and I think we touched upon it on last week's show, that the election deniers lost Secretary of State primaries in Ohio, Nebraska, and Idaho. That's the three that we've had before yesterday. And, you know, people were not spiking the football, those of us who, you know, are election deniers, because there are anomalous reasons for all three. In Idaho and Nebraska, there were three-way races that there were two election deniers splitting that vote, and the winner only had a plurality. So you could say, well, look, a majority are still voting for election deniers. And in Ohio, it was a two-person race, but the incumbent, who wasn't denying the election, had Trump's endorsement. So you could look at, well, they're still just following Trump's lead. But my reaction before Georgia was, if this is a grand conspiracy on Trump to install lackeys in every Secretary of State position, he's doing a really poor job of it because, one, he endorses the wrong guy in Ohio, and he doesn't endorse anybody in Idaho and Nebraska. When he could have tried to consolidate around somebody, he didn't even try. You would say, well, who cares about Idaho? But Nebraska has an electoral vote that Biden won in 2020. So we should care about that. And Ohio is, you know, Trump leaning, but not, you know, runaway red state. But here is Georgia, where he does actually put skin in the game. He does not only does he endorse Perdue and Heiss, he tries to clear the field for Perdue. He gets Vernon Jones out of the way to try to make that effectively a two-person race. He tries to raise money for them. And he makes their behavior, both Kemp and Raffensperger's, their handling of the 2020 election front and center. I mean, there's nobody he has harangued more than these people. Mm-hmm. And Georgia,
even going so far as to say, like, Stacey Abrams would be better, maybe, than Kemp, right?
Right. He said that at a rally. So, I mean, how else can you interpret this than just colossal humiliation? Yeah. I mean, it was just, you know, 2 weeks ago where J.D. Vance won the Republican primary with about 30% of the vote. And everyone was like, well, duh, this is Trump's party. Now, this is a cult. Clearly, anyone who thought any other result was possible was kidding themselves.
Bill, did you see NBC News yesterday did a montage? I saw this on Twitter. I think it was NBC. It was a montage of interviews of Georgia voters. And it was basically one person after the other saying like, oh, I love President Trump. Trump's awesome, but I just don't think he quite understands what's going on in the governor's race.
That was CBS.
Okay, my apologies. It was a really, I mean, it was very good. Mm-hmm. And it was just a never-ending cycle of people basically saying, oh, Trump's awesome, but I just don't think he quite understands this governor, you know, this governor person. Is sometimes I think he's confused about the endorsements. Like, you trust him with the nuclear code, but he gets confused when it comes to picking the right candidate for governor. But that's what it is. These people, as Jerry Seinfeld might say, who are these people? These people basically love Trump. They support Trump 100%. And they're saying, but I'm going to make my own pick when it comes to local who I'm voting for. And it's an interesting cognitive dissonance.
You know, we make fun of reporters who constantly go to Trump areas and interview Trump voters. And I agree that they should do that equivalently with Democratic voters. Because there are nuances to base voters. They're not two-dimensional characters. So you just said that these people love Trump. It may be some of them like Trump, but aren't drooling over Trump. I mean,
feel like they have to qualify. They're Republicans, and they feel like they have to really qualify how much they love Trump. Then they say, but, you know, maybe he doesn't always have things right. Now, here's the question, Bill, and I know I interrupted you and I got dinged in comments for interrupting you, but this leads, I think where you're probably heading is this leads to, like, is it possible for voters to then say, I love Trump, Trump is awesome, but it's time to move on to Ron DeSantis.
Also, by the same token, it doesn't mean that Trump can't win a primary still. Like, he's still obviously in the game and in a crowded presidential field, as in 2016, he can win primaries with pluralities like he did before. So he doesn't need to be the cult leader of 75% of the party to be the nominee again. But we need to have a more granular understanding of, you know, both the Republican base and the Democratic base if we're to understand our politics. It's not like the Republican base is becoming a bunch of John Huntsmen. You know, I'm not arguing that they are,
right.
You know, moving towards the middle of the country. We still see, like, as I wrote about Pennsylvania, we're still seeing people trying to out-crazy each other in many respects. So we shouldn't be sanguine, particularly for those of us in the left or the middle, don't be sanguine about the direction of the Republican Party. But it's definitely more complicated than whatever Trump says I does.
Yeah.
You can be a crazy right winger and not be obsessed about 2020 and want to do other crazy things that are unrelated to 2020.
Well, in fact, if you are a culture warrior who cares more about changing the culture than you do about defending Trump's legacy and reputation and ego, then you're probably more inclined to be a Ron DeSantis guy at this point. But I'm going to make a point, Bill. I think this is very important because, you know, I just interviewed this guy who runs the Fire Madison Cawthorn pack and now the Fire Boebert, Lauren Boebert pack. And you could check out, I had a podcast, my latest podcast, Matt Lewis and the News, an interview with him. And I wrote about it at the Daily Beast. But if you think about how Madison Cawthorn went down, Bill, you had a combination of factors, right? So you had this pack I'm talking about, the American Muckrakers, who was digging up dirt, having leaks and intel sent to them, just a relentless death of a thousand cuts for Madison Cawthorn of videos and pictures that they were putting out. I think some of it's psychological warfare getting under his skin. But you also had the fact that Madison Cawthorn had tried to switch districts and then had to go back, which I think hurt him. And then you had Senator Tom Tillis from North Carolina, Republican, who endorsed Cawthorn's opponent, who, by the way, was a state rep, a state senator, so somebody who actually had a political base. And you had this U.S. senator endorsing him, helping fund him. And so it took a whole bunch of things to take down Madison Cawthorn. And Bill, I think a similar phenomenon here is at stake. If we're looking at the model, if you look to Georgia, yes, I think what we had were voters who are showing us that they're not automatically going to vote in lockstep with Donald Trump's wishes and his endorsements. But it also took, you know, obviously an incumbent Republican governor and Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. And Kemp, the governor, ran apparently a great campaign. I don't know if you did you see this piece in Politico? It was something headlined to the effect of, do you remember the headline? It was very graphic. It's effing on or something.
Effing scorched earth. We're going to go effing scorched earth. Yeah.
So let me just read you a thing that jumped out at me from this column, Bill. It says, quote, "But Kemp worked to sway Hufstetler." So Hufstetler is a big donor who had been a Purdue donor in the past, right? "Kemp worked to sway Hufstetler during a 90-minute meeting." Let me go back here. "Kemp worked to sway Hufstetler during the 90-minute meeting, delivering what the developer later recounted to Politico as a lengthy and data-driven explanation about why he did not intervene in the vote count. Hufstetler walked away convinced and eventually donated more than $100,000 to back the governor." That's Kemp. "The courtship illustrates how aggressively Kemp moved to deprive Purdue of money, effectively shutting down his fundraising reservoir. The results were devastating for the former senator, who was outraised more than 6-1. Purdue, who had raised more than $99 million for his nationally watched Senate campaign in 2019 and 2020, disclosed raising just $3.5 million for the governor's race. While Kemp campaign spent more than $1 million on TV advertising during the final week of the primary," basically Purdue was dark that final week. So Purdue went from raising $99 million for Senate to like $3.5 million for governor because Kemp assiduously worked to shut down that fundraising. So it takes
this headline doesn't deliver. You know, if when you hear your effing score shirt, you think they dug through, you know, Purdue's garbage and found out that, you know, he was having sex with puppies, you know, and then you hear like what Kemp did was explain that he followed the law in 2020.
But he worked it. That's the thing, Bill. He went to the funders in Georgia. But first of all, he is the incumbent governor. So it's not like he's a, you know, Joe Blow. He's got a perch. He's got a platform, but he's also got the president of the United States trying to destroy him. And he's got a former U.S. senator. Something else, this is in the Politico piece, Bill. So Purdue's cousin is Sonny Perdue, former governor of Georgia, right? What does Kemp do? Kemp names him to some board of some university board. Guess who doesn't come out and attack Kemp? Sonny Perdue. Kemp's team, and the point I'm making here is...
Also Trump's ag secretary.
Right.
Right.
Good point. So Kemp worked it. He worked hard. And I think the same thing is true with taking down Madison Cawthorn. It took a whole bunch of things happening at once.
But what both things show is you can speak out against what Trump is doing or saying. You might have to be careful about it. You might have to really think it through and be strategic about it. But you can do it and not only survive, but even win big.
73%?
Right. I mean, because Trump is often peddling utter nonsense.
Yeah.
And if you take the time to say, you know what Trump is saying makes no sense, because you have to recognize if it truly is and nothing but a cult, then that wouldn't work.
Well, I do think it's – I agree. People are not – Republican voters are not zombies who are doing what Trump says. However, it's also fair to point out that, you know, you still have to say we love Trump, but we're not listening to him. Like, no. Trump has won in many ways. MAGA. And this is something, was it Barnett, the candidate who ran in Pennsylvania?
Yeah.
Came in third place, but she, you know, kind of overperformed what anybody thought she would do. And there in the last week or two was really scaring a lot of people. she was basically going around saying that, like, and I wish I had the quote in front of me, but she said something to the effect of, like, you know, MAGA isn't just Trump. Like, right. this is bigger than Trump. And I think it would be wrong to say that, well, the party's, you know, MAGA's not a big deal. No, it is.
Oh, yeah. No,
it just transcends.
The base is still crazy. Don't get me wrong here, Matt. I'm not saying the base isn't crazy, because it is. And they're going, I think, far, far to the right on a whole host of fronts issue-wise.
Yeah.
But I don't believe there's adult supervision in the party to keep them away from that. And they may end up nominating a whole bunch of people that blow winnable races in the midterms still. I mean, it's early. I can't make that prediction yet, but I think that's a risk for Republicans.
But I agree with you. But I do want to, as a conservative, I do want to put down a marker. I agree with you that the base is still crazy. However, I think that Kemp and Raffensperger seem to be honorable mainstream conservatives who could have existed in the Reagan framework, irrespective of Donald Trump's existence. So, but in other places, like, for example, Ohio, you know, it's fair to say, like, well, J.D. Vance only got X number of percent of the vote. Yes, but the other options were Josh Mandel.
Right. Like, there's still cases where people are trying to out-crazy each other.
Yeah, yeah.
However, there's – and I've written about this. So I'm not saying I don't have to be introspective here. And it wasn't – there's been a deep, deep concern amongst Democrats about election subversion. Rightly so. I mean, because Trump did try to overturn the 2020 election. Trump did try to engineer a coup. He went to great lengths to try to do that. It wasn't idle chatter. And there are attempts to install people to do that sort of thing. Now, the Times just did a big piece about all the state legislator endorsements that Trump is putting out there. So it's not that we don't be vigilant about that sort of thing. And we still should try to pass some kind of Electoral Count Act reform to cut off those possibilities of threats to Electoral College ratification in the future. So I'm not saying these things are silly or overly hysterical. But Trump is not succeeding in making this central to the Republican Party's being, because it would appear a lot of Republican voters care about other things. They're not solely wrapped up in Trump, that they want to have the entire party overhauled to simply make it so he becomes president regardless of what the vote count is. They care about abortion. They care about transgender issues. They care about guns. You know, there's all sorts of culture war type things that I think motivate them that go well beyond what Trump's doing today or tomorrow.
And another point that confuses this whole narrative about, is Trump, you know, is Trump the kingmaker? Is Trump a joke? It's Herschel Walker. You know, while, you know, Kemp and Raffensperger win big, and Herschel Walker wins big. And
well, here's a case where the Republican establishment didn't even try. They have said, you know, Mitch McConnell. I mean, Mitch McConnell, you know, he's been pushing up against Trump in many ways. He's not usually cowed by him. He came out and said, I know Herschel Walker. He's a good guy. He's going to be great. And I don't know, did he really have a fantastic meeting and McConnell was really impressed by him? If he just thought, you know, there's just I got nothing else to work with here. This isn't the fight I want to fight. But here's a case where, again, I can't know. I'm not saying Herschel Walker can't beat Warnock. Maybe he can. But if I'm a Republican, I got to say to myself, we couldn't find anybody else. Yeah.
Well, I mean, Herschel Walker obviously is a celebrity. He obviously has a certain charisma and appeal. And he will be well-funded, I'm sure. To me, this comes down to, does Raphael Warnock follow the lessons that we just have talked about when it came to beating Madison Cawthorn and beating Purdue?
Well,
he going to run a smart? Is he going to run? And again, it's not a scorched earth. And maybe this should be scorched earth if you're Raphael Warnock. Is he going to run a good campaign?
I mean, I think it's safe to say they're going to just completely bludgeon Walker. I mean, they're sitting on tons of oppo that wasn't used on him in any kind of serious way by fellow Republicans. So he got a very light primary, and now he's going to get the deluge. So number one, I don't think that Democrats going to hold back at all in that respect. Now, in terms of Warnock's, you know, the positive part of his campaign, you know, he in 2020 had a fantastic ad campaign. You know, him with the puppies and, you know, smiling sort of suburban dad Warnock. But he didn't really tack much to the middle issue-wise. He ran kind of a typical Democratic campaign. He wasn't hard left. He wasn't single payer. He wasn't Green New Deal. He wasn't abolish ICE. But it was pretty standard, you know, solid progressive positions, and proved that in, you know, I wrote about this because I reviewed Greg Bluestein's book Flipped about Georgia. You know, Georgia is purple enough, as we've learned, that you could run that campaign and perhaps juice the African-American base vote in Georgia just enough. But perhaps it also requires Republicans shooting themselves in the foot and depressing their own base. And it may be that some of the wounds of this primary, maybe the hardcore Trumpers and the hard-do Purdue voters, maybe they don't turn out for Kemp. Maybe Herschel Walker has enough problems that some part of the Republican base doesn't turn out for him. So you may get another perfect storm of factors that allows Warnock to survive, but it's not going to be a Kirsten Sinema campaign. You know, Warnock's not running as a centrist type. He's running as a blue progressive Democrat, and we'll see if that can work two times in a row.
I will say, and this is, you know, just me sitting in West Virginia, so my perspective is different than voters in Georgia, certainly, but it did feel to me that when he was running for office, that Warnock presented sort of a fuzzy, sweet, almost culturally conservative in some ways, nice, pleasant image. And I feel like since then, he has governed more as a serious left winger. So my perception of him has changed. And I just imagine that it'll be harder for him to recast himself again as a more of a cuddly candidate. Is that just my perception?
Well, I mean, I suspect the ad campaign is going to maintain that brand, maintain the cuddly brand. But the voting record is just one of a Democrat. He's not being cute and like throwing in a few Republican votes. So you can't say he doesn't vote with Chuck Schumer, you know, 95% of the time, you know.
Well, I think so this is irrespective of ideology. I think he presented kind of a friendlier, softer image in the campaign and has not lived up to that image. In terms of votes, it's worth asking, should he have been more moderate? Would he be in a better position today to beat Herschel Walker if he had voted more moderately? Or not. I don't know.
I mean, Georgia seems like, you know, kind of like Wisconsin in that you got some very red and very blue. I'm not saying there's no purple in the state, but, you know, both Ossoff and Warnock ran pretty blue campaigns and squeaked through. So to get, you know, Metro Atlanta to turn out big, you know, maybe it made sense for Warnock to be hardcore on voting rights. And I believe he's going to be hardcore. I just heard him, you know, I know we don't want to talk a whole lot about what happened in Texas. But he said right out, he's not shy away from a gun vote right now. Whereas, you know, plenty of times in the past 10 plus years, you've had Democrats in reddish states not really relishing the prospect of taking a gun control vote. Warnock is not shying away from that. He's made his bet as Ossoff has and Stacey Abrams has. You know, they're running as Democrats in Georgia, and it worked in 2020, which was a blue trending year in general where Republicans made mistakes. Now here we have presumably a red trending year, but Republicans are still making mistakes, perhaps. So it might still work out.
I do think, though, in 2020, there was a sense where Democrats tried to run in a way as conservative in some ways. Like, I think even Joe Biden, who ended up governing to the left, tried to run as a very non-threatening moderate. And I feel like Warnock was part of that as well. And it's kind of a bait and switch. Can't do it twice.
Maybe you can. You know, I still think we can predict it just yet. Particularly, there's always other factors with the Republican intra-party fighting and Walker's, you know, long paper trail here.
And in addition to Herschel Walker, we've got Marjorie Taylor Greene as well. I mean, she's not going to run statewide, but she will be back. And it's interesting. I mentioned the campaign that took down Madison Cawthorn and is now focused on Lauren Boebert, who is up in next month.
So is there a real serious effort to deny her renomination?
Yes. Boebert?
Who's the alternative?
So just like in North Carolina, there's a state rep. So a couple things. So I talked to David B. Wheeler, who's the head of the American Muckrakers Pack. He ran the effort, the Fire Madison Cawthorn effort. And now he's in Colorado. I spoke to him yesterday he was in Denver. And it's called Fire Boebert. And he says that the districts are very similar. Remember, Boebert beat a five-term incumbent Republican congressman who was endorsed by Trump. And she's currently being primaried by a Republican state rep. So it's similar to the Cawthorn in that regard. It's similar to Cawthorn that there's like a legitimate state rep or state senator who's running against her. And also, I mean, obviously, she's had so many like weird brushes with the law. I don't know if you want me to go through them or not, but there's a lot of information. There's a lot of stuff already known about her that could potentially sway voters if they knew. And there probably are other things that have yet to come out. So I don't know. Like, you know, again, we're getting conflicting messages, right? Like Cawthorn is defeated, and yet Marjorie Taylor Greene coast to victory in her primary. So like, it's hard to say that there's a trend, but it does seem like there's a chance that some of the ingredients that we saw take down Cawthorn are present in Colorado with Boebert.
Yeah. I mean, you know, trends might be hard to tease out. I just think it is a party that lacks a true leader. And so you're going to get weird things happening on a case by case basis, depending on, you know, who's better organized.
Well, like there's a way of looking at it and saying like, are you insane? Look, Republicans just, you know, renominated Marjorie Taylor Greene. They just nominated Herschel Walker. They just, you know, nominated Mooney and J.D. Vance. Like, are you insane? There's no way they're going to take down Boebert. And then there's a way of looking at it and saying like, well, you know, but they took down Madison Cawthorn and they just, you know, Raffensperger just won. So maybe they will. Maybe they can. Like, maybe it's possible. It's hard. I think you could make a compelling case that Boebert is unbeatable or that she's incredibly vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other notable primary result last night, it's not called yet, but Texas 28, this was a rematch, it was a runoff between the incumbent Democrat Henry Cuellar and progressive activist Jessica Cisneros. You know, they ran against each other in 2020, a close race. I was close enough to make it to a runoff this time. And at last count, Cuellar was up by 177 votes. Unclear how many votes are left to count, but not many. And narrow enough that we could get a recount. And here, you know, Cuellar is pro-life. He's the one Democrat to vote against the codification of Roe that the Democrats took up earlier this year. and also is friendly to the gun lobby, and even was part of some FBI investigation involving his dealings in Azerbaijan that his lawyer claims that he's no longer a target of the investigation. That's not been fully, it's not been formally announced. But this is one of those Texas border districts that's very Latino, but as we've learned, that doesn't mean it's progressive. And the Democratic leadership rallied around Cuellar to the ire of progressives, including AOC, who complained about it just last night, and sort of posed the question, you know, what's the point of this? And I even responded on Twitter saying the point is because this is a right trending district and Democrats want to have some shot keeping the majority. You know, it's a classic case of, you know, the progressive critique is, you know, what's the point of having a Democrat if they're going to be anti-abortion? They're going to be pro-gun. You know, what can you do? How can you govern like that? And I think the evidence here is Democrats still passed in the House codification of Roe. He was the one vote. You know, so it's mathematically meaningless that he has that position. He's not the guy holding up the judicial confirmations or anything like that. And, you know, other progressive legislation has passed the House. I mean, the problem for progressive legislation is the Senate. And even there, you can say, yeah, Manchin is actively thwarting Democrats on various things, but other things still got through, especially judges. So Manchin has not been a problem in that respect. So, yeah, in our majorities, these people can limit your agenda, but history is they don't completely obliterate your agenda. I can't know if Cisneros could win that district and maybe she still pulls it out and becomes the nominee and we find out. But clearly the leadership position was, you know what, this is tough enough keeping the House. We'd have to make the job even harder by taking a flyer on a newbie. You know, Quayle's got real relationships on the ground. He's the incumbent and he has some crossover appeal. Let's not take chances here. So that seems to be the logic of it. But it's also not like the Democratic establishment is winning all these races because Kurt Schrader appears to be being beat in Oregon 5, a redrawn district where he wasn't as well known in some parts, and appears to be losing to a more progressive Medicare for All challenger. And this is a light blue district, but I think your pal Henry Olson has said there are some Republican candidates that have done okay, you know, for governor or secretary of state, done okay in that district. So in the right circumstances, a Republican could win there. And perhaps 2020 is going to be a set of those circumstances. So I think Democrats are a little nervous about what might happen there. But, you know, it's still a place that Biden won. So it's not implausible that it's McLeod Skinner that she could win, even though the incumbent appears to have lost that primary.
Well, speaking of Texas, Bill, from the Texas Tribune, George P. Bush's defeat could be the end of the line for a four-generation political dynasty. Bush's defeat in the race for attorney general could mark the end of a four-generation political dynasty and the end of an era of Texas politicians that began when the first George Bush moved to Odessa in 1948. Bill, big deal, little deal, no deal.
Well, I mean, I think it's a big deal. I don't know. I mean, you know, I would never count a Bush out at some point in time. It's not a family that, you know, stays on the mat. So maybe there's a great granddaughter, a great grandson that's going to get back in the game at some point.
It's not just Texas, right? Prescott Bush,
Pierce George Bush,
H.W. Bush's dad was he a senator?
Oh, right. Prescott was a senator in Connecticut, if I recall.
So this is it's not just a Texas thing. This is a long-term dynasty that goes back 100 years or something crazy like that. I don't know.
You know, my father, many, many years ago, would always say to me, you know, watch out for that George P. Bush. I don't think he was alone. And this is not just a Bush. This is a Bush who is part Latino and for Republicans who thought that the future involved being a more diverse party, having a Bush who was in a diverse family,
right,
was seemingly political gold. And instead, the Republican Party has diversified somewhat, but it's by being like super anti-immigrant and super culture war and even attacking things like Black Lives Matter and whatnot, but trying to find those conservative African Americans, those conservative Latinos, and those conservative Asian Americans and conservative Indian Americans, and recognizing, hey, they like some of this stuff. They like some of these culture war things. So George P., and he tried to be Trumpy. He broke away from the rest of the Bushes and didn't talk smack about Trump.
Remember he put out the koozie?
Yeah.
It was like a beer koozie that said, it was a quote from Trump that was like, this is my Bush, or this is the only Bush I like, or something. Right. I forget what it was. It was super embarrassing, though.
Well, you know, going back to George H.W. Bush, I mean, the reason why he got as far as he did was he broke bread with the John Birchers in Texas. You know, he was always the establishment country Republican who, you know, didn't mind getting his hands dirty with the farthest extremes of the Republican Party. And he took that to the White House, and he bent his past positions into a pretzel to be Reagan's, you know, VP. So they have a history of doing what it took.
Yeah.
To keep the party together.
But then Bush, I think as he did, it was an interesting dichotomy because he seemed willing to do whatever it took in a campaign to win, but then governed as he wanted to govern.
Yeah.
And I think it's in many ways underrated as a actual president.
And even George W., who, you know, was more conservative than his father, you know, still did Medicare Part D, still did No Child Left Behind, you know, still had some, his political antenna was, and he even tried to do immigration reform. He had that political antenna of, hey, we got to find a way to marry the middle with the right. Served him well enough to get to be the president.
Yeah.
But that model of governing is not the Trump model, and even though Trump might not be literally a cult leader, it's not the model that a lot of Republican base voters really want. And so even though George P. wasn't even trying to hawk it, he still may be seen as the symbol of it. And that's not what Texans wanted.
Well, he's young, so maybe there's a future, but he may have to wait, as John Mayer might say, for the world to change. So
I mean, he's got time. What strikes me about George P. is here's a guy. I mean, you know, his, you know, George W., he didn't go run for city council first. He just went straight to governor. And people thought at the time that he was getting ahead of himself. And might have even humiliated himself by going up against Ann Richards. But nevertheless, you know, prove those doubters wrong. Here's George P. saying, I'm going to pay my dues. I'm going to be land commissioner.
How hard could that be?
Yeah. And I'm going to vote for attorney general. I'm not even going to go for governor right away. Here's a guy who could have waited. He could have waited for Abbott's time to be over.
In Texas, there are no term limits for governor. So, you know, Rick Perry was governor for like 18 years or something. So it's not like in Virginia where you just wait 4 years and you get your turn.
So I do think it, I mean, clearly it's easy to say in hindsight, but you know, at the time you could say, why are you primarying a ultra conservative attorney general? I understand he was scandal ridden, but scandal doesn't necessarily disqualify her sometimes. Why would you rush to take on that race when you could have just bided your time and waited for an open governor seat, waited for an open Senate seat? I mean, Ted Cruz and John Cornyn aren't going to stay around forever. I mean, Ted Cruz is barely a senator now. He's podcasting half the time.
Everybody wants to do what we do, Bill, because it's so glamorous and well compensated. So
I'm very curious what the average Texas voter thinks about Ted Cruz pontificating about Pete Davidson's romantic life when you should be being a senator.
In fairness, though, Pete Davidson there's a lot to discuss. We don't understand why this dude has so much appeal to the ladies. And I think it's worth, you know, it's worth some time. We have not, I think, paid sufficient, attention to this phenomenon, Bill.
I don't understand why he has appeal to people who like comedy. That's where my puzzlement is.
I don't get it either.
But I wouldn't go. I wouldn't go on about it if I was a senator. I'd be doing other things.
Yeah, I think maybe Cruz could spend his time more efficiently for the people. But again, I think there's still a lot left to be said about the Pete Davidson thing. But we'll leave that to TMZ or something.
I mean, I don't want to be a total stick in the mud. Like, you know, you can be in politics and be frivolous sometimes. It's okay to tell jokes and go on TV shows and talk about silly stuff sometimes. But I think it's weird to host a podcast while you're a senator that's not primarily focused on, you know, your work. It just seems like it's not like this is some dry podcast about what legislation's in the queue. He's often just sort of going on about, I mean, not that I listen to it a lot, so forgive me if I'm speaking out of a place of ignorance, but from the clips that I see that come across Twitter, it seems like he's just going on about random culture war things and not really talking about the job that he's supposed to be doing.
It's Hollywood for ugly people, as they say. Not that he's ugly, but I'm just saying everybody wants to. They want it to be Hollywood. They don't want to talk about impact fees, you know, or something like that. Bill, again, we wanted to focus this episode on politics and elections because that's what we do here, and also because we've sadly had to. We've probably talked about gun violence and mass shootings many times in the past and probably said everything that we could say. But I guess we should acknowledge this because it's driving the news and it's horrific. And
well, it's horrific and traumatic. And I'm at a loss for words precisely because we've talked about it so much. And I've said all of my bad takes on the subject that are depressing and uninspiring. And I feel like everything that I've written about it keeps coming to bear. I mean, people are so dug in on both sides of the issue that there's a tweet that it always gets recirculated that once America decided that the killing of children was bearable, the debate was over. And that we still seem to be in the same place. So, I'm sure it's going to impact politics in a certain way that people are going to talk about it again. But as far as it actually producing legislation of some sort, I have no optimism there at this point.
I would recommend David French's piece at the Dispatch about red flag laws, which would seemingly be something we could all agree on, no matter where you stand on gun control, quote unquote. Something to check out. Anything, Bill, that...
Just to say about that quickly, I think people do agree about red flag laws. And we have red flag laws in a lot of places, but they utterly failed in New York. I mean, we had a teenager who expressed thoughts of murder-suicide, had some kind of mental health evaluation. It didn't produce a red flag actually occurring because he talked his way out of it. I mean, there's a whole lot of things that can make sense on paper. I'm not saying they shouldn't be passed, but... they're hardly foolproof measures. And, you know, I know you don't agree with me on this, Matt, but the places that don't have these mass shootings, one of the points that I and others often make is, you know, most gun deaths are not mass shootings, they're suicides. And we don't talk about the suicides because they're not as publicly traumatic, but that is the vast majority of gun deaths. And if we talk about that every day they happen, which is pretty much every day, maybe the conversation would be different. But that's handguns. And the way you stop that is by banning handguns. And that's not a political, that's a political non-starter in America.
I would assume though that New York State, I'm assuming, has some pretty restrictive gun laws. California, where there have been some of these instances,
you can't patchwork it. It's just one thing that you can't. I mean, I think you're going to see with abortion, you can ban abortion pills in Texas, but someone's going to ship them in. So it requires a national policy. And obviously, it's not going to be amenable to a hardcore Second Amendment person. But other countries do it, and that's how they do it.
All right, Bill. On that said note, anything you want to promote that you've written about or politics this week?
I got something in the queue. It's not published yet. I think it's going to go up tomorrow unless, you know, events require schedule changes. But in the book, This Will Not Pass, the book by Jonathan Martin and Alex Burns of the New York Times reporters, which is about 2020 and the aftermath of 2020, it was revealed in there that there's some friction between Obama and Biden. And Biden had apparently said privately that Obama is not happy that Biden's presidency was being seen as more transformative than Obama's. This was earlier in the administration, in the immediate aftermath of the American Rescue Plan. And it just prompted me to say, look, we have these two theories of the case about how to legislate. And the more partisan view that Biden embraced, I think with some reservations, but embraced it, hasn't panned out. I mean, you can do a very objective scorecard between Obama's first 18 months and Biden's first 18 months. And I think Obama comes out way ahead. And so I go through a lot of that, why I think things panned out the way they did. But I do think this is a moment that's worth reassessing this argument, because we can look at the points on the scoreboard.
All right. I would check out my podcast, Matt Lewis and the News. Last week, I talked to Tyler Cowen, the economist, about spotting talent, you know, how to assess talent and people who are undervalued or not appreciated. If you're looking to hire somebody or work with somebody, how can you look for underappreciated talent? And then, as I mentioned, I talked to David B. Wheeler, who is in charge of that PAC that was involved in the Fire Madison Cawthorn and now Fire Lauren Boebert. And we got into, you know, that they're the PAC that published the nude video of Cawthorn. That was controversial. And in fact, Act Blue deplatformed him, cut off his funding for that. So we got into that conversation about some of the ethics involved in slinging mud, but maybe for a real good cause. I think didn't John Candy, the movie Brewster's Millions, how do you plead? And John Candy's character says, guilty, Your Honor, but with a real good excuse. So anyway, check out that podcast. Bill, always a pleasure. And I mentioned the Boebert's up next month in June. Anything on our radar electoral wise?
Oh, I should know that, but I don't.
All right.
I haven't looked at the calendar.
I'm actually, I think we're out next week, barring some earth shattering news. We're taking a break next week, but then we should be back in 2 weeks and hopefully get on a run and we'll keep doing these. So please subscribe to the YouTube channel. It's youtube.com/Matt Lewis. And I have a DMZ section. And Bill, what's up with the audio podcast?
I got to get that fully set up. I still got to do a couple things.
Okay.
I mean, it exists. We can put out the link on our Twitter and Facebook feeds with the Buzzsprout audio link. So that exists. But to get it on, you know, iTunes and Stitcher and whatnot, I still got to do a couple things. So
subscribe to the YouTube channel now, youtube.com/Matt Lewis, to make sure you keep getting alerted to these. And probably within the next 2 weeks when we're back, hopefully we'll have a new audio podcast channel. Because if you're like me, you like to consume podcasts while you're driving, while you're jogging, in the shower, whatever, easier to listen. So, but we want you to subscribe to our new feed, because at some point the Blogging Heads DMZ current feeds may go away. I think they probably will go away. We don't want you to lose us or us to lose you. So we'll keep you posted on that. Bill Scherer, always a pleasure.
See you in 2 weeks.
See you back in the DMZ in 2. Thanks, man.